Friday on the Fan Morning Show. On New Year's Eve, it's Justin Cuthbert and Haley Salvian who's filling in for the last time for Ailish Forfar. I did get a message from her yesterday, by the way. I guess she got back into like cellular range.
Okay.
She's fully indoctrinated as a Northern Ontario Ontarian now.
Okay.
Spending her days shoveling snow and drinking Bush Light. So there's the Ailish update.
What a life.
What a life. I said New Year's Eve. I guess that we'll just go right into the icebreakers, because do we really want to talk about all the heartbreak that Toronto sports suffered last night? Not yet, at least.
Okay.
And it has to do with New Year's. One.
Okay.
Do you like New Year's?
No, I don't care.
Not a New Year's person?
Most of the time, like, I feel like the last few New Year's Eves for me have been, like, watch a movie, you know.
Not make it till 12?
I'd make it till 12. If I'm not doing a morning show or something like this, I stay up pretty late. I don't know why. I just stay awake.
Yeah.
And then I regret it in the morning. But yeah, I haven't really done a whole lot on New Year's. Typically, I'll be watching a movie or I'll be doing something and then I'll look at the clock and it's 12. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, cool.
Yeah, I'm not a New Year's person either. I hate if you're in like a big group where you all have to like hug and kiss and like right after New Year's, just like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah,
I don't really want to do that.
Don't touch me.
Maybe like, you know, your significant other, you do that. But like when it has to be everyone, it's like, that's not how I envision starting my year.
Why are we all hugging?
Yeah, I don't know. The clock just turned to 12. That's just about it. Second one, I guess this was more personal.
Okay.
Because you set goals, right?
Sure.
New Year?
Yeah.
Do we accomplish our goals in 2022?
I didn't set any.
No, you're not a goal-setting person then.
No.
No, I'm not either.
Yeah.
We can bond over New Year's.
Yeah.
We can.
Just like, hey, what'd you do today? Nothing. Sweet, me too.
Yes, it was the best day ever.
I will say my one New Year's take is... like, enough with the people who get, like, with the gym regulars who then get annoyed and rude about all the people at the gym on January 2nd. That's my least favorite thing, is we get this, like, stretch of time where people think it's cool to make fun of people who decide to start going to the gym.
Yes, the hardos.
Like, yeah, and they're just like, oh, I've been here for years, or I've been here all the time, I come here every day. Like, oh, now it's the New Year's resolutioners. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
Let people go to the gym. Shut up.
They start huffing and puffing in
the
gym.
Do your workout and let them do their thing and just shut up.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm with you on that one. Although
that's my one New Year's take is don't be that guy who's like, well, I don't need a resolution because I do this all the time. Cool. Congratulations.
So will you be in the gym on January 1? You said you don't set goals, but is that like a thing where you're just like, that's a reminder? Oh, I got to start working out again? Is that something that clicks in your head or you're just like, nah,
no.
Nah.
No.
I'm not that person either. Because, like, it shouldn't be that day. It shouldn't be January 1. If you just want to make a decision on December 15th.
Work out if you want to work out.
Make the decision on December 15th.
Yeah.
You can decide at any time to make a life change. It doesn't have to be January 1. And in fact, when it's January 1, it probably is less likely to last.
I mean, the gym is probably very, probably very busy, on January 1. So I get it.
Also,
I can understand, like, general... grumpiness at, you know, trying to go into your gym and it's packed.
Yes.
But also just don't be rude to people.
This is also the time to put on a little insulation in the winter. Stay warm.
I'm not going outside.
Do what makes you happy.
Yeah.
Unless to come here. You do have to go. Oh, you barely have to go outside to come here.
No.
Are you garage to garage? You
yes.
are garage to garage. You don't even
yes.
have to go outside.
Nope.
So I
did have to go outside today because my phone fell in the crack in the seat of my car. So I had to pull over and try to find it.
Oh, that was while you were on the road.
It was like right when I pulled out of the garage and then I heard the clang.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, well, I'm not going to listen to the radio.
No.
I need my phone to put on a podcast.
Exactly,
I'm just kidding.
Exactly.
So I was outside fishing for my cell phone.
Well, it's unseasonably warm, so it's kind of messy out there.
I wore a vest today.
Exactly. We don't even have to wear jackets on New Year's Eve. Anyway, busy night in sports yesterday. Both Toronto teams in action, the Leafs and Raptors both lose in different ways, but we kind of teed it up. It's kind of fake game night. Weird game with the NFL, Thursday night football. Canada plays Austria and blows the doors off them as expected at the World Junior Hockey Championship. Oh, we'll start with this because we're not going to talk about Dallas and Tennessee at all. Freaky, freaky final score.
Yeah.
So we always talk about, does Vegas know? Does Vegas know more than it should, or how would it possibly know this and that?
Mm-hmm.
The spread's 14. I don't know if it closed 14.5, 13.5, whatever. Spread was around 14 when it closed. The team totals were around 27 for the Dallas Cowboys and around 13 for the Tennessee Titans.
Okay.
And the game ends 27-13.
What do they know?
Both scores correct, the spread correct. It's a little freaky when it happens that way because you think that you're just like voluntarily involving yourself in something that you clearly have a huge disadvantage in.
Mm-hmm. It's like one of the examples that you should just show people who think that they can always kind of like beat the system. You mm-hmm. know, guys who go on a hot streak and like, oh, yeah, yeah. It's like, no.
Or
the book always ends up winning.
The book always knows. Or maybe just an evidence to like bet teasers and things like that because you know Vegas is going to be at least pretty close.
Yeah.
And if you bet both teaser side last night, you'd be well within range because the two teams did as expected. Mm-hmm. The Leafs did not do as expected.
No.
Unless you consider the historical
maybe they did.
historical dominance that the Arizona Coyotes have had over the Toronto Maple Leafs. Four losses in the calendar year for the Maple Leafs against the Coyotes, of course, dating back to last season. So if there's a New Year's resolution for the Leafs, maybe number one is beat Arizona next time you get a chance. Four losses is pretty, pretty wild. I will say, like, it's kind of an anomaly. It is an anomaly. But there is something about how Arizona approaches these games. And it wasn't as obvious this time as it was back in Toronto. I think they played, I don't know if it was October or November. Probably October.
Yeah, the beginning of the season.
Where it was just complete shell-out mode for the Arizona Coyotes. It's like they didn't even want to endeavor to do anything. It was five men behind the puck. It was shelling up and making it so that they just, the Maybe Leafs rather, just worked around the perimeter.
Yeah, clogged the middle and be opportunistic.
And I don't think it was as deliberate last night.
No.
And of course, they got out to an early lead, and that might make them even shell up even more. But the Leafs, for some reason, have an issue with Arizona. Do you make any sense of it?
I mean, it's hard to make sense of it because I think it's probably a mix of, it's tough because you see those games and you think like, well, they're just taking their opponent lightly. But when you've already lost, you're heading into this game and you've already lost three games, the Arizona Coyotes in the calendar year. And the last one in October was a 4-2 loss, like you said, where, and that was, I remember that game being really frustrating. And that was the game where Sheldon Keefe kind of called out the Leafs elite players. It was like, think of the difference between us and Arizona. Like, we have elite players.
That was the
game, right?
Yeah,
that was the elite players game. Because I was at that game, and I think Jonas, my colleague at The Athletic, was sick, or he was off that day. And so it's, you know, I'll go cover the Arizona game. Nothing's going to happen. And
braving the outdoors.
Yeah, I went outside in October, and that was it. I haven't been outside since. But that was the elite players game. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, the Leafs elite players did not make the impact in that game. And so you would think that, you know, you'd learn, maybe come out differently in this one. It's hard to make sense of these because maybe it's a mix of the Leafs taking the Arizona Coyotes lightly. You know, you're underprepared for that game. You're not trying as hard. I don't know. I just think
the other team's trying really hard.
Yeah, the
Super Bowl stuff.
Yeah. I just don't think there's like a good reason for it. And that's the problem with trying to make sense of it. I think Arizona can play a frustrating style. Sometimes mm-hmm. they can just clog up the middle. We, as you said, we didn't see it that deliberately last night. But we've seen the way that the Coyotes play frustrate other elite teams like the Colorado Avalanche, but the Avs are missing several players, so that's something to keep in mind. I just think Arizona has a way to frustrate you because they can like dictate how the game goes with mm-hmm. the different style that they play. I think what the Leafs haven't been able to do against this team clearly consistently enough to get the 2 points is be the ones to control how the game is played. And that's obviously an issue because the Leafs are a much better team than the Arizona Coyotes. So I can't make sense of it. I think it's a mix of things. Guys not showing up. You're not getting up for that game.
Mm-hmm.
Arizona Coyotes are working very hard
travel,
to beat them. I don't know.
Goaltending. A lot of things.
I mean, last night there was some, like, weird execution things. Like, I know there's a broader, trend here of mm-hmm. the Leafs losing to the Arizona Coyotes this year in these four games. But there was some stuff, like, specifically we can look at last night that was not good. Like, Matt Murray wasn't mm-hmm. great. The
on the first shift.
Yeah, like what happens there? I mean, Justin Hall tries to knock the puck down. He ends up falling, knocking Mark Giordano on. Auston Matthews loses the puck battle on the wall. And then they go in and score backhand on Matt Murray within the first minute of the game on the first shot. You know, Arizona gets two shots on goal in the first period, and it's a 2-1 hockey game. Like, that stuff shouldn't happen against really any team, let alone the Arizona Coyotes. And then it was the first goal by Jack McBain for me, too, where I was like, what happened here? Mm-hmm. Because McBain just basically went backdoor on Timothy Liljegren, uncovered. Liljegren gave him, like, a little check, and that was it. And he still just got into the paint easy. And then the point shot comes. I don't recall exactly who it was from, but the shot from the slot comes, and he's basically shooting to pass, and Matt Murray doesn't move.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he just didn't move. So even if he's playing the shot, he still didn't put a blocker up. He didn't use a stick. He just kind of stood there frozen on his post. And I was like, what just happened here? It was a very strangely executed hockey game. It was just very weird.
Well,
I don't know what to make of it.
I'm glad you brought someone else into it, because Morgan Riley, wearing a little bit of it on the at least on Twitter throughout the fan base, he did give up the puck, I believe, on that Jack McBain goal. So, you know, he stepped in. He was a big part of the first two goals scored by the Leafs' second unit power play, just controlling things or helping control things and helping Connor Timmins get into a good spot to make something happen. But, you know, I think we should give a little grace to Morgan Riley. First game back in over a month. Yeah, I mean, there's going to be mistakes. Unfortunately, mistakes have become a little bit more of a part of his game than we really, really want or expect out of a number one defenseman. But we'll, you know, if we're going to give guys like Matt Murray grace, guys like Ilya Samsonov grace, the entire team grace for a pretty bad performance despite them winning in St. Louis, I think he deserves at least to get through one game without all the pitchforks and torches out for him.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I just think the last point I'll make in terms of the playing down to the opponent conversation, I talked to Dominic Moore about this in October, actually, after that first loss to the Arizona Coyotes, and I was trying to pull up what he and I talked about back then, and obviously he played a long time in the NHL, played for the Leafs for a stint.
Yep.
And I was kind of poking around and saying, like, is this a real thing? Is playing down to an opponent a real thing, or is this just radio fodder? Is it a media-driven narrative that we use to try to explain why these things happen sometimes? And he was like, yeah, it's definitely a real thing, and it mostly stems from, one, underestimating or not giving enough respect to your opponents, or two, knowing that you, and it's part of it, knowing you don't have to play your best to win, which often means that you don't, right? So the Leafs, you go into that game and you know we don't have to be grade A tonight across the board to beat the Arizona Coyotes, which means that they aren't grade A. They're not executing on those things. They're not bringing their best. And, you know, this, it's still the NHL. The Coyotes are bad, but they're still the NHL. Mm-hmm. And the Coyotes were able to be opportunistic. They scored on, you know, the one of two opportunities they got in the first period, and they end up winning the game. I mean, it's just, I would say that after this happening three times in the calendar year, one time already this season, that you would have liked to see the Leafs not potentially not have that mindset coming into this one. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they wanted to come out strong and have a great game, but obviously 6-3 loss to the Arizona Coyotes would suggest that that maybe did not happen.
Yeah, that's pulling deep from the psychology, obviously, but I think you can apply that to most things in life. Like, if there's a situation where you don't have to be fully attentive, when you can be 90%, you choose to be 90%.
I didn't have to be on my best on this show because it's not mine.
This.
I'm just kidding.
So we're getting, we'll see what percentage we get today.
Yeah.
No, but that, I just think that's exactly how life goes, and there's probably something deep in the psychology for the Arizona Coyotes as well, where they're one of the few teams in the NHL that is exceeding expectation. They're not really involved in the Connor Bedard
sweepstakes. Which is a mistake. Like, you watched Connor Bedard do what he did yesterday and said, let's go and beat the Leafs. Like, what are you doing?
Admittedly, it might be a flawed thing. But, hey, maybe they want to get the generational superstar in 5 years, the next one that comes down the pike.
So they can have it with their new arena.
So they can have the arena. If you get Connor Bedard too soon, well, you might start winning games, and then it's an issue that you're playing in a 5,000-seater. Anyway, I digress.
Okay, also, Vince Vaughn was at the game.
Very strange. Like, why?
Anyways.
He was right behind
the
goal,
too. He was,
like,
on the glass,
too. So Kerfoot scores, and, like, Vince Vaughn's just right there.
He looked, like, kind of upset.
It's so distracting.
He was, like, distraught Vince Vaughn on Alex Kerfoot.
Yes. That game was tracking well. Actually tracking in a way that would have been pretty positive result, right? Like, okay, last game, we're talking about the elite players not doing elite things. Well, sometimes you got to win games without the core four doing things. That's been the problem for the Leafs, is like you're relying almost exclusively on those four guys to get it done. We saw it in St. Louis. It had to be a special play from William Nylander to salvage the 2 points. In this one, first power play kind of sags, and we could talk about five forwards on the power play or not, doesn't really matter. The second power play comes out with two defensemen, Riley and Connor Timmins, and in very limited time, they get two goals. They get a lead for the Leafs despite giving up a goal in the first period, and that's the type of stuff you want. Alexander Kerfoot adds to the lead, and you're in a good position where you can win a game without relying on your core four. That stuff is positive. It becomes a negative when you don't win the game, when you end up giving up a couple empty netters and lose the game 6-3. We can start talking about the core four again. But again, they've given themselves some grace. They've earned themselves some grace. They played so, so well over the last couple months here. I will say, though, second line is not exactly clicking. John Tavares doesn't look like the John Tavares of the first 6 weeks of the season of the last month here. Mitch Marner, if you look at the advanced numbers, really good stuff. Power play, really good stuff. Special teams, of course, he's a force on the penalty kill. But that line, that second line, hasn't been dominant of late. And I think a lot of it is seen through Tavares. And it's been sort of a minimal impact, at least on 5-on-5 from that group. So the couple things that are starting to pop up is the top six, can they maintain that level? I think there's a little valley here right now, at least with the second line.
Yeah.
The defensive game. Yeah, you have a lot of options. But are we seeing little cracks? Are we seeing, you know, difficulties handling teams in transition? Are we seeing mistakes? Are we seeing defenders collide into each other and goals scored in the first minute of the game? Yeah, there's a couple things that we can nitpick. But
bizarro
also,
world stuff.
Bizarro world stuff, but also the goaltending too. Samsonov asking for a start, looking bad for like the third or fourth straight game, despite all the wins. And then Matt Murray comes in. We were worried about him being cold. Well, he looked pretty cold in that game, not playing particularly well. So a couple things to consider here. It's not going to be rosy all season long. Leafs might be encountering one of their little slumps here. And it kind of, when it's slumping, and when it's, you know, we talked about the margins being thin and how much you focus on, hey, how good does the blue line have to be? If you're going to play these low-scoring games, how perfect do you have to be defensively? How good does your goaltending have to be? How much do you need your core four to score every single night? Again, if the margins are thin and something isn't exactly working, the Maple Leafs look a little bit more vulnerable.
Yeah, I think one of the things last night is, you know, looking at that second line, just jumping off what you're talking about with Tavares and that second line within the top six. I mean, he hit the post on the power play 10, 11 minutes in. He takes the tripping penalty, and that line didn't generate a whole lot at 5-on-5 last night, despite Cali Yarncroke having, you know, a good impact on the second power play unit. And I do believe that he fits in well with Marner and Tavares as that second line winger. I think there's reason to believe that that is the right fit there. He can retrieve pucks. He's good on the wall. He battles hard. He works hard. And when he is the guy who ends up getting the puck in the slot, he does have a nice shot. He's consistently was a 15-goal guy around that in Nashville. So I do like the fit there. But yeah, last night, they didn't create a whole lot offensively, and their defensive numbers were good. I mean, they didn't have really any. The Arizona Coyotes barely had any chances against when that line was on. But like a really good defensive effort against the Arizona Coyotes, you know, on December 30th kind of isn't the expectation for a line with Mitch Marner and John Tavares on
right?
Tavares had one shot on goal in 16 and a half minutes. Like, that's just not... That doesn't stand out. And again, yeah, sure, it's fine when you're, you know, your bottom six guys or your depth players or someone outside of the core four is carrying the load. But at the end of the day, you lost the game, and you would have maybe liked to see a little bit more from guys like that. I thought, the goaltending is a bit of a question mark right now. Obviously, it's only been two. I guess it's been more. But as of right now, post holiday break, it's been two games we're looking at. You know, not a great Samsonov performance, and Matt Murray not having a great game against the Arizona Coyotes. The Coyotes scored six goals, two were on an empty net, but they only generated 2.57 goals in all situations. So that's not a great, like, goals saved above expected number. I don't have a calculator in front of me, but it's, you know, what, three and a half, goals
against two empty netters.
Yeah, so... Even still, Matt Murray's not, it wasn't a great Murray performance.
No.
Against the Arizona Coyotes again.
Tells you that too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you just look at the goals, you look at, you know, how little opportunity Arizona had in some of these situations, especially in the first period. Just wasn't a great game.
No, it wasn't. It's the first regulation loss the Leafs have suffered after trailing through two periods. They were 16-0-4 before that, and it's just one of... eight regulation losses all year.
Yeah.
Two of them have come to the Arizona Coyotes.
And that's the thing with the conversation about the Leafs right now, too. Like, I do hope we've gotten to a point where you know, a regulation loss to the Coyotes. It doesn't need to be a referendum on this team. Mm-mm. I mean, they're third in the NHL still,
yep.
and they haven't lost in regulation a whole lot. Yeah, it was a stinker. It's not great. Sometimes that can just happen.
And this
we don't need to like, what's wrong with the Maple Leafs?
Yeah, and this is
yeah, they
this,
lost the Coyotes.
You can't
whatever.
Apply this Coyotes game and playing down to the opponent when it matters most, which is the you have to play up to your opponent
yeah,
or play.
Let's just hope
even,
that they don't play the Coyotes in the first round
exactly,
of the playoffs.
No, that,
ha ha.
We could just you know plan our trips after the
yeah,
playoffs.
Book your flights.
Book your flights. Definitely. So it was a revenge game or a revenge spot for Connor Timmins. He scores or doesn't score. He gets two assists, sets up two goals, two primaries. And Dryden Hunt will have the opportunity to have a revenge game himself. And the Leafs will have certainly a measuring stick type game on Hockey Night in Canada Saturday against the Colorado Avalanche as they continue this road trip. It's interesting that you said or we talked about playing up or down to your opponent or playing 85% intensity and it affecting you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I saw 85% intensity from the Memphis Grizzlies last night, and it didn't affect them at all. In fact, they were perfectly...
They were just chill.
...expending energy.
Yeah.
It was so economical. It's like, oh, you got this back to single digits? Let's get Ja Morant back on the floor, and he can give us about 75% effort, and everything will go back to normal, which is a double-digit advantage yeah. for the Memphis Grizzlies. Let's start the Raptors conversation with Nick Nurse's exasperation after another tough loss and a loss which didn't meet his standards in terms of effort and intensity.
Well, yeah, I don't know if that play tonight gives me much optimism at all. That's pretty unacceptable with the effort we gave. I thought the loose ball count was all in their favor. I'm not talking about 50-50 balls either. I'm talking about ones where we had huge advantages to get. And we just, you know, that's our identity of who we are, right? Like when we're tipping balls away, we're the first ones to the floor to get them. And we weren't close to that tonight.
So I get what he's saying. It's about more about the Raptors, right? What the Raptors have to do to be successful. They have to be all in. They have to be 100% because they're not, frankly, as talented as Memphis Grizzlies. But you watch that game and like, I didn't see one team outworking the other. In fact, I saw one team like wasting energy while the other one used it perfectly, as I mentioned, and economically. You mm-hmm. watch the Memphis Grizzlies are just more comfortable. They understand exactly what they're supposed to do. Yeah, Dylan Brooks worked his ass off because he wanted to scream at the crowd and say this is his house because he's from Toronto, and I get all that yeah. stuff, and he shut down Pascal Siakam pretty brilliantly. But I don't think it's an effort thing with the Toronto Raptors. I think that there's just like, there's not enough talent. There's too much on these players' plates. There's too much confusion. There's too much defensive responsibility that they're juggling and trying to handle. And maybe I said paralysis by analysis earlier with Scotty Barnes. Maybe that's seeping into the entire group where they're just being asked to do too much because they're not that good.
I mean, it's a fair point. I think it's tough to put a finger on the Toronto Raptors right now because I think you hear what Nick Nurse is saying, and you watch that game last night, and yeah, it looked like the Memphis Grizzlies didn't really need to turn it on all the way. I mean, did the Clippers have to turn it on all the way the other night? Probably not.
No, they didn't.
And you try to think of, like, what is the identity of this Raptors team right now?
It was supposed to be defensive.
Right. But
acumen and hard work.
Exactly. But teams are coming in, and they're putting up, you know, 119, 126, whatever mm-hmm. it is, you know, how many times...
With relative ease.
Yeah, and how many times are teams putting up, you know, 120 points on the Toronto Raptors right now? That's not a defensive team.
No.
Like, what are teams saying when they're coming into Toronto for a game? Like...
It's points night. It's get right
yeah,
night.
Yeah, and that's bad, obviously.
It's let's set career highs and assist night if I'm Ja Morant, and I don't need to score the ball because yeah. I can let everyone else do it.
And sometimes it just seems like the Raptors are spinning their wheels and trying to figure out what's wrong, and they're trying to get on track, and I'm not sure what the right way out is. I mean, I thought you watched that game last night, and Ja Morant, I mean, he got to be the facilitator. He puts up a career high in assists, and he's so explosive. Like, that first step was just a problem all night, and you knew that it was coming because mm-hmm. when you watch the tape and you prep for Ja Morant, you know that he's got an explosive first step. He can get you on the dribble and get to the paint very quickly, and he's an issue, and you want to see the Raptors, you know, pushing him out, making sure the ball gets out of his hands, or making sure he's, you know, forcing shots from behind the arc, and we didn't see that consistently last night. So I don't know if it's like the Raptors like, I understand what Nick Nurse is saying. I do kind of agree. Like, it's a consistent lack of execution when I watch this team, mm-hmm. because they consistently struggled last night to string together stops, right? And you kept hearing it from Matt Devlin. You hear it on the broadcast. It's like, all right, so the Raptors just scored. Let's see them get a stop. And they couldn't. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how are you going to be competitive against this Memphis Grizzlies team when every time they go down the floor, Ja Morant is, you know, kicking it out to somebody behind the arc, or he's throwing it down? Like, how is this a recipe for success?
Yeah.
And I remember I don't mean to bring it back to hockey, but it was my first year in Ottawa covering the Senators, and that was a bad team. They were a rebuilding team. The Senators lacked a ton of skill. They weren't very good, but that didn't mean that they weren't a hard team to play against. And that's what we're not seeing with the Raptors right now, right? Is the Sens were bad, but at least they had the identity that they were going to go to work. And when teams came in to play the Ottawa Senators, you'd hear it from the visitors' locker room. It's like, yeah, this isn't going to be an easy night. This isn't an easy 2 points when you're playing the Ottawa Senators, because they are going to work, mm-hmm. and they're going to grind it out. They play physical. And that was the identity that you know, 31st team in the league had, is like, yeah, the Ottawa Senators are not very good and we can probably have our way with them, but it's not going to be that easy. And is that what the Suns are saying right now heading into Toronto tonight?
Maybe the Raptors haven't been able to embrace that because they thought of themselves as better, right? Maybe this is all part of the humbling experience of like, oh yeah, we're closer to the 30th ranked team than we are the 12th that we thought we might've been coming in, where we can give trouble to those above us rather than be troubled by those below us. We celebrated Nick Nurse's box and one in the NBA Finals and all this like innovative stuff, but now it's like born out of desperation. They boxed and won for Ja Morant yesterday, and yeah, it did slow down Memphis, but it just made it a 4-on-4 game, which Memphis ended up winning. Mm-hmm. Took Ja Morant out of the game, but it didn't matter because you couldn't take advantage of taking a player like Ja Morant out of the game momentarily.
And taking him out of the game is him putting up a career high assist.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and he was so good in the third quarter. And there was a point where the Raptors made it a game, and it gets within 9 in the fourth quarter. But then the Grizzlies, you know, just stop their run, put in their starters, and they take over again. Like, I don't know, when the Raptors got it to 9, yeah, you're enjoying the game at that point, and it's fun to watch, and you say, yeah, great effort, but did anyone actually think the Raptors were going to pull that out and win the game? I don't know. It's a strange team right now. It's a strange team to watch. It's a strange team to try to evaluate. Will Lou is coming on.
Will
maybe have better answers.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, what's their identity and what comes next?
Well, it's a stark contrast, too, in terms of team building, because from a team building perspective, you look at Memphis 1 through 5. They're, you know, pretty elite at the one with Ja Morant and Steven Adams. If you put him against a lesser center, he's going to feast exactly like he did last night. They built their team, I guess, more traditionally, but also soundly. And then so you see the 1 through 5 and all the strength that they have up and down the lineup. The Raptors tried and started Scottie Barnes at the one yesterday. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's not a traditional point guard matchup. Clearly, they're not going to see each other in the defensive end of the floor, Ja Morant and Scottie Barnes. But one is easy. One makes sense. The other is like, oh, we're just trying to make the pieces work. We don't have enough. Mm-hmm. And that couldn't be more clear when you watch the Toronto Raptors right now.
The rim protection and the lack of
the physical element,
the lack of the natural center. We talked about that the other day too. There was like a really key moment in the game in the fourth quarter. There's like 7 minutes left. Memphis is up 10. The Grizzlies miss a layup, and instead of the Raptors getting the defensive rebound, breaking out and making it, you know, a 7 or 8 point game, Steven Adams gets the offensive rebound. They get a second chance and they go up 13. It's just a game-breaking moment in the fourth when the Raptors are all in it, and that's the exciting part. As you said, they're making a game of it, and then they get exposed on the offensive boards, and now it's a double-digit, or already a 10-double-digit game. It was a 10-point lead, but then it goes back up to 13, and you're like, oof. Like, that was kind of a moment where you're like, oh, yeah.
Back to where it belonged.
Yeah.
the Toronto Raptors also waived Justin Champagne yesterday. I don't know if that means something's coming down the pike. We'll ask William Liu if that means anything or is just a decision on a player. Lastly, let's get quickly to the World Junior Hockey Championship. Canada beating Austria 11-0 last night in the nightcap in Halifax. The story really is and remains to be, and remains rather, Connor Bedard, who ties the all-time Canadian record before reaching draft eligibility, mind you, scoring his 14th goal at the World Juniors. Both he and Jordan Eberle, who did own the record by himself, did it in 12 games. Now, it's a little bit different because Eberle did it, I think, in just two appearances of the World Juniors. That would make sense if he played 12 games in two World Juniors. This is Connor Bedard's, technically his second tournament, but it's his third time with the World Juniors because, of course, the tournament was canceled midway through last winter due to the pandemic. Connor Bedard did some damage early in that tournament, and his stats do still apply and carry over. He added to it in the summer. He's adding to it again. He's been impeccable. He's been unbelievable. He's been the single driving force behind, or the most powerful driving force at the tournament this year. His 27 points, just four shy of the record held by Eric Lindros. We could be talking about one of the greatest juniors of all time at the end of this run for Connor Bedard. And oh yeah, I guess he could be there next year if he really wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I mean, I think he has two more years of eligibility. He could play in the 2024 and 2025 World Junior Championships. He probably won't, because we're probably going to see this guy actually playing in the NHL next year. The numbers are just incredible. I know that Eberle, you know, scored some very, very big goals for Canada at the World Juniors. And that is something that we will look to and hopefully see from Connor Bedard as evaluators, as Canadians, as hockey fans. You hope that, you know, sure, you can pad your stats against lesser competition in a preliminary round without a team from Russia, for sure. So what is he going to do when the games matter the most? What's he going to do in the quarter semis finals if they make it that far? But at the same time, like, we can still appreciate the work that this guy is just doing right now. He has 14 points in three games in nine periods of hockey. 14 points right now. Yeah, say
and
what
you
want.
And scoring goals in just, like, ridiculous ways.
Oh, my
ways.
God. The sharp angle shot yesterday, I watched that, and I was just like that. He's a sicko.
He's an alien.
Yeah.
It's not a lot.
Like, he's a freak. He's the fastest kid alive, you know. It's just amazing to watch, and I think the feeling when you watch Connor Bedard lately, at least for me, is just like, I can't wait to see this guy in the NHL.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that shot is going to translate. He's got a smaller frame. We'll see, you know, is he going to be a center? Is he going to be a wing? What about the defensive side of the puck? Whatever. I don't care. I cannot wait to see that shot in this player in the NHL. He is something special. And this is, he's still the youngest player in the tournament, by the way. He doesn't turn 18 until July.
Mm-hmm.
He's 17 years old, youngest player in the tournament.
And clearly
14
the best
points
player
in three
tournament.
Games. It's his tournament.
Yeah.
It's his tournament right now. And yeah, it's super fun to watch. It almost makes you forget sometimes that this is, you know, on paper, when you look at how many first round draft picks are on the team and how many returning players are on the team and how many NHL players are on the team, that's something we need to remember too. There's three guys who came from NHL rosters to come and play in the World Juniors, and I don't care because it's Connor Bedard's.
Yeah,
it's the Connor Bedard show.
He's outshining all of them for sure. He's the last thing I'm actually worried about when the games mean more, when we don't have to just turn them off after two periods because there's other things going on. Like, when it matters the most.
Yeah, last night was a lot. I was like, I'm sorry, I'm done.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it, Connor Bedard. We have seen it. There are other issues clearly that are, well, not even issues, just other things to consider that might be, you know, determine whether or not they do in fact repeat as gold medal winners. But for at least one night, the goaltending was good. Ben Gaudreau rebounds, gets the shutout. Great for him.
Yeah.
Still decisions to be made there, I think.
May have been the last time we see him, though.
May still be the last time, but at least he gets a shutout out of this World Junior Hockey Championship.
People can stop yelling at him. He's just a child.
Word to the wise, do not put Canada on the power play. Last bit for the first block here. Pelé. Died yesterday. Brazilian soccer legend at age 82, football's first global icon, and a winner of a record three World Cups. Now, I always do this. I always, not that I'm waiting for anything, but I find myself, I need to learn more about Pelé now. And we shouldn't wait for legends and icons to pass before we, you know, dive into their world and learn more and more about them.
Yeah.
But now I feel like this is, not that I feel it's my responsibility, I want to learn more. I want to dive into Pelé content. I'm going to do that this weekend. But just another reminder, like, shouldn't wait, because he deserves celebration, obviously, today, yesterday, for his entire career. He deserves that recognition. One of the first, like, global superstars, athletes who everyone across the world knew, household name. Pelé was one of the first, and the world said goodbye to them yesterday.
Yeah, it's sad when you see that come through, and obviously we knew that he'd been sick. He'd been in care for a long time with colon cancer. I think, and I will say, if you want to be watching something, there's so many like Pele documentaries mm-hmm. and movies. Like this was, you know, one of the definitive people, faces, characters, players in soccer. He's the only person in history, man or woman, to win the World Cup 3 times. Like one of the best players ever to do it in the world. You see the reaction from the soccer community yesterday too. Lionel Messi and Kylian Mbappe, you know, everyone's posting about Pele and how inspirational he was. And the thing for me is because, when he passed away, you go back and you start watching like old clips and you start looking at the Pele highlights and mm-hmm. stuff. And one of the kind of wild things is like looking at some of the clips and watching some of the highlights. You look at some of the photos and you're watching like a Pele back heel, which is something that, you know, you don't always see right now mm-hmm. in soccer. And you're watching them black and white. Yeah. You know, he was just so elite. So like at a time, it was just a strange thing. It's like, you know, 1950s
with a ball World that maybe Cup. Weighs 10 times as much yeah. as they do now yeah. and cleats that were, you know, not what they are now, clearly.
Just such a special
and
player.
He's doing the same things, yeah.
With such an elite skill set. And yeah, you're watching it in like a black and white clip. Just an incredible player. He had such a huge impact on the game, not just in Brazil, but globally. And rest in peace, Pele. He was the king for a reason.
A marvel. I'm paraphrasing, but I believe when Maradona died, he said, "Someday I hope we get to play again together."
Yeah.
And I hope Maradona and Pele are playing together right now. After the break, we're going to dive into a little NHL, general NHL discussion. I gave Haley some homework. I wanted her to tell me the story that will define the remainder of the NHL this season. We'll discuss that next on the Fan Morning Show with Justin Cuthbert and Haley Salvian. Back on the Fan Morning Show, Justin Cuthbert and Haley Salvian. I should mention, we got a busy show today. Great guest list. Great guest list. Charles Davis to talk about the NFL at 9. Follow that up with Will Lew, as we mentioned, discuss the Raptors. And then in the 10 a.m. hour, we have Frank Saravalli and Luke Fox, little NHL two-pack there. For now, let's kick off that NHL discussion. I'm sure you appreciated me giving you homework last night, Haley.
Yeah, it was great.
I asked you to give me the story that will define the remainder of the NHL season. I think both of us had trouble pinpointing just one, so we'll open the floor. What sort of sticks out when you think about the narratives, the discussion, what we'll be talking about, what's important when considering, I guess, the unofficial second half of the season? We're not quite there yet, but the holiday break does represent something of a midway mark. What's on your mind?
Yeah, and the 2023 portion of the season coming up pretty quickly. I think we talked about a lot, a big one yesterday. I do think what happens with Patrick Kane, does he stay, does he go, where does he go, is going to be a major storyline, and it's going to have a big impact too mm-hmm. On Kane, his legacy in Chicago, on the Chicago Blackhawks. You know, how bad did they get if Kane's gone, if Taves is gone too? Like, I think we could just circle what the Chicago Blackhawks do at the deadline is a major storyline, because you can trace, you know, where does Jonathan Taves go? Does he end up going to one of the teams that everyone keeps talking about, you know, Colorado Avalanche, team that needs, you know, a better second line center, an upgrade at the 2C.
What does he look like in a better situation?
Yeah, I mean, because Jonathan Taves has not been, you know, great this year. I mean, and I think when you look at the two, Patrick Kane is, you know, still the kind of, despite the fact that his numbers don't look great, but Patrick Kane is, you know, the more elite, skilled player.
The guy you can
right
drop
now
into any situation, you feel pretty comfortable he's going to be productive.
Yeah, so I think that's a big one. That's going to have like a major impact on, you know, 2 to 3 teams if both of them go. And then, yeah, how bad do the Blackhawks get? Do they get Connor Bedard? I just think there's a lot that we're going to be able to trace there. Where does Patrick Kane go? We talked about it yesterday, I'm sure. I don't want to rehash the whole thing mm-hmm. because we talked about it a lot. So I'm sure you can listen to it on demand if you want to catch up on your favorite podcast platform. But, yeah, where Patrick Kane goes, where does Jonathan Taves go? How bad do the Chicago Blackhawks get? Do they get Connor Bedard? That is going to be a massive one.
Yeah.
And then obviously the impact of those guys on whatever team they end up being on, right? Is it Colorado with Jonathan Taves? Mm-hmm. Is it the New York Rangers with Patrick Kane?
Is there a surprise team involved in both of them? Will those two even decide to leave?
Exactly.
I was reading in The Athletic yesterday that the discussions, we had like December 1st earmarked. I think we were talking about that a lot with insiders, so on and so forth. Maybe it's just a month later because it seems like the conversations are going to start happening in earnest now. And I know that I'm hoping that both of them go, that we see some fireworks, that it gets involved. But the Chicago Blackhawks could very well be the ones to push over the first domino. I extend this conversation to Erik Karlsson. Watching Erik Karlsson again, who leads the NHL in even strength points, or 5-on-5 points, might be even strength. Either way, he's having this incredible season. He's captured what he was, what, 6, 7, 8 years ago. I just really, really, I think he's the fish. I think he's the biggest fish out there. I think he's the most impactful player.
You actually think he's going to get moved?
I think it's a possibility.
Who can afford that?
Well, if the San Jose Sharks are willing, and there's a third party,
I'm with
anything
you.
Anything can happen.
I think that's really interesting. I'm tracking that too. I think a lot of people are going into this conversation about Erik Karlsson and thinking like, yeah, the Sharks will retain half. Why would they do that?
I don't think they'll retain half. Well, they want to be bad.
I don't think they're going to retain because they have salary cap problems in and of themselves.
They have a lot of
big, old, aging contracts. He makes $11.5 million.
I don't think they have any interest in winning. I think 25% is reasonable. I think a team like the Arizona Coyotes, who clearly doesn't want to win,
Even still, you're going to need another team, and what team can afford 75% of Erik Karlsson's contract?
They might be 25% of the third party. Again, it is far-fetched, maybe, in a league where no team has any money.
Yeah.
The salary cap is not going up. But
the Sharks are bad, they have $2.4 million in projected deadline cap space.
And I guess that's the point. Like, they can't escape the hell that they've put themselves in. So why not, you know, add another log onto the fire and make the next 3-4 years really bad by just taking away another, what's 25% of 11, take away another $2.75 million of your available cap space and just try to get the maximum return from it. I guess this is me more hopeful than anything.
Sure.
But
you want to see Erik Karlsson on a contender.
I don't want to see this wasted. Like, this is so, him in his prime was as entertaining as hockey got. He was so good for the Ottawa Senators when he was in his prime. Maybe we're getting another little pocket of his prime here. I hope they find a way to move him because I just think it'll be great for Erik Karlsson and great for the game. And I guess when we're talking about who could move, that is the story of the second half of the season.
Yeah.
But I think when we're talking about, okay, who might be looking to add, I think the biggest story is how much better can the best team in hockey get? And that's the Boston Bruins. The Boston Bruins always find a way to add. They always find a way to do something productive at the deadline, even if maybe they shouldn't even be that aggressive. They got Hampus Lindholm last year.
They turned around
and extended him for, I think, a maximum term, at least 7 years. And
he's probably one of the reasons why they were able to be so good off the start of the season with so many injuries.
Exactly. He's been a huge, huge factor for them. And they survived those injuries, as we mentioned. But guess what? They still have guys like David Pastrnak, severely underpaid. Brad Marchand, still on a deal. I think he signed before the World Cup of Hockey in 2016. Like, they still got all these value contracts. And that's not even mentioning the best value contract, the steal that was the circumventing style contract given to Patrice Bergeron, where it's incentive-laden, bonus-laden, and it affects them next year as opposed to this year. I think the Boston Bruins have all the reason in the world to try to get even better than they are. They always seem to do it. This is the year for Patrice. I just feel like they're going to be the most aggressive, and it's not if they get better, but how much better does the best team in hockey get? I think that's the biggest story of the second half.
Yeah, and what are they going to be able to do to get better, right? Again, it's really lame because we're in a flat cap world, but they do not have a ton of wiggle room. Like, this is a team that's capped out, and they're not even in LTIR. So I think their deadline cap space right now is like $255,000. So you're going to have to move money out. I think the Bruins are really interesting because when you look at their roster and you look at their contracts, there's a ton of guys who are unrestricted free agents this summer.
Yeah.
So I think the Bruins are an interesting team to look at.
It's
like, how are they going to be able to capitalize on this window right now? Because, Pastrnak's an unrestricted free agent. What happens with him? Do you just hold on to him because you guys are really good, even though you don't know if he's going to come back? You have to.
You have to.
You can't do, and that's bad if you lose David Pastrnak for nothing in the summer. But you can't get rid of him at the deadline because the team is good and he's an elite talent. And maybe they can re-sign him. I'm not quite sure.
There'd be a sword in the back of Patrice Bergeron.
Can you imagine? But that's something I'm looking at.
They can't. They can't possibly. They're the best team in hockey. You got to go for it.
And it was the same thing. I mean, we had these conversations in Calgary with Johnny Gaudreau. And everyone's playing revisionist history on it. It's like, well, why did they just lost Johnny Gaudreau for nothing. Like, what happened? It's like, what are you going to do? Trade Johnny Gaudreau at the deadline last year? No, the Flames won the division. Like, you're not doing that. No. Yeah, it's terrible what happened. It sucks. But you got the cap space. That's your return. And then what do you do with it? So the Bruins are very, very interesting. If you're looking at the storylines around the Boston Bruins, not just for this season, but in 2023, like, can they capitalize? Can they win right now? And then what happens in the offseason? I mean, because Nick Foligno's a UFA, Pavel Zak is a UFA. They're not as big names. They're not the same as David Pastrnak. But does Patrice Bergeron come back? Does David Krejci come back? Was this it for them? Was it just a one-and-done year for them? And then how do they kind of retool if those players do end up leaving? Mm-hmm. How do you retool around Jake DeBrusque and Taylor Hall and Brad Marchand and Charlie McAvoy, Hampus Lindholm? The Bruins are so interesting. And they're part of the storyline for me. When I'm looking at the storylines that impact the NHL, you know, for the rest of the season, I'm looking at these kind of legacy teams in the Eastern Conference, right? And which ones, multiple, are going to be the legitimate contenders in the postseason. Mm-hmm. You know, which of the I'll believe it when I see it teams, you know, the ones where it's like, yeah, well, the Washington Capitals are probably, people are saying, you know, they're going to miss the playoffs. I'll believe it when I see it. Like, I'm never going to write off the Caps, the Penguins, the Bruins or the Tampa Bay Lightning. Those are teams that are just always in and around it, and their window is just forever open, it seems.
Yep.
Which windows are actually going to close and which ones are actually elite contenders? Those are the teams that are going to have so much power and sway in the Eastern Conference when it matters the most. Like we were talking, that's going to be a dogfight to get out of the East. And it's teams with guys like Patrice Bergeron and Sidney Crosby and Alex Ovechkin, Steven Stamkos. These aren't the, like, young gun stars in the NHL right now. They're still studs. They're still doing it. And are they going to be able to take their team all the way when it matters the most? That's what I'm tracking. I think the Eastern Conference is just going to be so, so interesting.
I think Pittsburgh's fascinating because, you know, we talked at this time last year, like, they could have the ultimate fire sale. They could absolutely liquidate the remnants of a Stanley Cup champion and finally turn over a roster and add to the prospect and futures cupboards that
you
have been barren forever.
You can't do that when
Sidney
Crosby is playing the way that he is.
Yeah. You can't do it. And I thought that this summer was maybe the time. Last year was maybe the time where you could, like, we can get something out of the last 2-3 years of Sid because we can turn this over quickly and get there.
Yeah.
But they doubled down on Rust, which, of course, you doubled down on Rust, I guess. But you doubled down, more importantly, on Chris Letang and Evgeny Malkin. That was prioritized in the offseason. Yeah. They went back to the well. And yeah, you're right. They go back every year. But now do you just have to accept that it's not about 5 years? It's not about post-Sidney Crosby. It's about the Sidney Crosby era. And we've got to add to this team if we're going to hang with a team like the Carolina Hurricanes. If we're going to get through our division and meet a team like the Boston Bruins in the Eastern Conference Final, or the Toronto Maple Leafs, or the Tampa Bay Lightning.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you're Pittsburgh, you're kind of like half in, half out. And in order to get what you really want, which is probably success, continued success in the Sidney Crosby era, you're probably going to have to give up what you've been trying to preserve. When Ron Hextall came in, it was like, okay,
yeah,
you got to balance this thing. You got to get, you got to make sure you get something out of these draft picks, but more importantly, protect them.
Sure.
And also get something out of this aging legacy core that they have. I just feel like you can't do both. You can't satisfy both.
No.
And if you're choosing between two evils, try to support Sidney Crosby. He continues to play at an extremely high level at age 35.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're talking about Erik Karlsson leading the league in 5-on-5 scoring, and Sidney Crosby's not far off, and he's leading the league in 5-on-5 goals right now. He's 35 years old, and he's on pace for, I don't have it right in front of me, but, you know, another massive season from Sidney Crosby. I think you could argue, I don't think Crosby's going to win the Hart, but you could argue that Sidney Crosby is as valuable as ever to the Pittsburgh Penguins, the most valuable guy in the Penguins again and again and again, and he's 35 years old, one of the best, most impactful players in the league still. I think the interesting thing about the big three conversation and bringing back guys like Malkin and Letang in the offseason, and when we were having the conversation, like, well, Evgeny Malkin wants the extra year that the Penguins aren't willing to give up, like, who cares if you're going to be paying Evgeny Malkin for one extra year, a little bit more, the window's going to be over by then. This is about their legacy in Pittsburgh at this point. That's what we were talking about with Malkin and Letang, because right now, like, your window is Sidney Crosby's three years left on his contract, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, he probably comes back. Maybe he goes somewhere else. I don't know what the future holds for Sidney Crosby and the Pittsburgh Penguins, but your window is this three-year contract where Sidney Crosby is still one of the elite players in the league. And so who cares if you're giving Evgeny Malkin $6 million in 2025? Your team's probably not going to be very good by then.
No.
Just let him retire a Penguin. Who cares? It's all about right now. Yep. And Crosby, Malkin, and Letang. I mean, Letang's been, obviously, he comes back from the stroke. He's dealing with a lower body injury now. So there's been some, you know, up and down things with Letang's health. But those three guys haven't been the problem in Pittsburgh. It's been the window dressings, I think, that was the issue. With the Penguins, bringing them back and having those three locked in isn't why the Pittsburgh Penguins are a tier below. Penguins are 6-2-2 in their last 10, but they've been blowing some leads. They lose a couple games in overtime. There's like this general, this feeling of kind of like unease in Pittsburgh around, yeah, this team's very good, but I don't think they're good enough. Can they beat the Carolina Hurricanes in the first round of the playoffs? I don't know. Maybe all you need to do is get a couple good games from Tristan Jarry and Sidney Crosby takes over. It's not impossible.
Yep.
But the Penguins are going to be a really interesting case study around the deadline, because again, they don't have a lot of cap space. You know, if they're not going to be, again, I think they're a tier below the like Bostons of the world right now.
Currently, yeah.
Most teams are.
Yep.
So do you make a big deal at the deadline to go all in because Sidney Crosby's playing so well, or do you hold on to those assets? Like, what do the Penguins do here? Do you go all in because you want to win, or do you say this year isn't probably the year because the Bruins are very, very good? I think there's going to I'm very interested in the East and all these teams.
But it gets less and less likely.
The Penguins particularly are very interesting too.
It gets less and less likely for a team like the Penguins to be, you know, wise to push it off 1 year.
Dumoulin has just fallen off a cliff too. And
it's not going to last forever. We'll switch gears after the break. Charles Davis, who will be on the call for the Miami Dolphins and New England Patriots in week 17. We'll catch up with him after the break.